Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Yes, and happy Rohatsu, Awakening Day. Right? This was Siddhartha Gautama's big day, apparently. In East Asia, this is the day that, I think most of East Asia, most of China, Korea, Vietnam, I'm not completely sure either, that this is the day they celebrate the awakening of the Buddha, commemorating that, and enacting it in various ways. In our little zendo, we just kind of sat through most of the night ourselves. Some of us here, some of us did it for everybody. And in other places, they sit for the whole week and don't sleep, laying down. Korea, I know, is one place where it's done, and some places, you know, more traditional monasteries, I think in Japan, they still do it as well. Pretty tough. Pretty tough. When I sat down and started to think about writing a talk for Rohatsu, a really strong sense of reluctance kind of arose in me. Because I thought, how could I possibly have anything meaningful to say about the awakening of Siddhartha Gautama? That time when he became a Buddha, or received that title of Buddha, which means the one who is awake. And it's not that his awakening seems, too sacred or too mystical to approach. Because really, it's been the theme of Rohatsu talks probably for hundreds of years. But so much has been written and said about enlightenment. Just wait a second here. Come on in. Welcome. So much has been, you know, said and written about this idea of enlightenment, particularly recently. There are all these very kinds of enlightenment. There's a magazine called Enlightenment, or at least there was, and all these people who are self-enlightened, whatever that means. That I think for many people in this kind of day and age, enlightenment, it has become a commodity. You know, something perhaps we don't perhaps have yet, right? But we want it. Like that purple Mercedes-Benz, or the red Miata, or the swimming pool in the backyard. It's that other thing we need for some kind of lasting happiness, right? Like smooth skin and the right vitamin supplements. And then we'll be happy once we get everything lined up. So enlightenment, this idea of enlightenment, can really just become another object of desire. Something the ego wants. And that's important for us, I think, to think about. Why do we sit? The word enlightenment itself, of course, is a noun, right? The enlightenment. But originally, as you probably know, it was coined referring to the 18th century rationalist movement in Europe that arose. And it kind of strove to understand the world, you know, using logic and rational thinking. And then somewhere in the 1800s, some of the early translators of the Buddhist texts, the Pali texts, started to use that word to represent the awakening of Siddhartha Gautama. But it was really that really prolific writer about Zen, D.T. Suzuki, whose name may sound familiar to some of you, who really popularized the word enlightenment in his writings for some kind of very sudden and transformative spiritual experience. the big zap. And unfortunately, this noun, this word enlightenment, and our kind of common understanding of it as a single kind of epiphany really obscures and misleads. When we look at the early Buddhist texts and most of the writings from our Zen ancestors that have written about this in various ways, often in poetic form, I think it's pretty clear that we don't get zapped and are transformed into something else. But really, we undertake a lifelong journey of spiritual growth, which includes gradual and sudden transformations. Even in the legendary story of the Buddha, who sat under the Bodhi tree and received his great awakening, his great experience, even in that case, we read that, you know, he continued to practice. He continued to meditate and practice for the rest of his life. In fact, he devoted his whole life to practice up until his death. So I think this experience, this awakening, is better thought of as a verb rather than a noun. You know, some kind of ongoing process, or maybe even that's giving it too much weight. A kind of a waking up to our whole being with nothing left out. I was thinking about the legendary story of the Buddha where, of course, he has this very wonderful life. Everything's given to him on a silver tray. His father particularly tries to prevent him from experiencing any kind of discomfort in his life. And then, of course, he sees the four heavenly messengers, as it's sometimes called, or the four sights. See someone sick, severe old age, death, and then a mendicant, a wandering monk. And that's when his journey really begins. I think that's when he begins to awake. He begins to wake up when he realizes and looks carefully at his life and what is in store for him. I think that's the beginning of awakening. Wake up to our whole being with nothing left out. The Japanese poet, a woman, Izumi Shikibu, who lived in the 10th century, wrote this little poem about her own awakening. She had a very interesting life, was involved in lots of court intrigues. She was connected to the court and many lovers and all kinds of things. She grew tired of that, kind of woke up in some way herself and became a religious practitioner and a bit of a hermit. Anyway, here's her poem. Watching the moon at dawn, solitary mid-sky, I knew myself completely, no part left out. Watching the moon at dawn, solitary mid-sky, I knew myself completely, no part left out. Awakening. And yet, as Suzuki Roshi, the Zen teacher who brought this form of practice from Japan to North America, Suzuki Roshi once said, "There are, strictly speaking, no enlightened people. There is only enlightened activity." Our path, or a journey, or practice, I think, is to bring forth into this world over and over again enlightened activity, kind of awakening our whole being with no part left out. You may ask, well, what does that mean? No part left out. Awakening our whole being. Well, to help us explore this, I'd like us to look at one of the key Zen texts from this particular school, one of the Soto key texts, called the Denko Roku, or Transmission of the Light. The Denko Roku, it's this book here, is a koan collection. It's a collection of short writings meant to kind of encourage us to really reflect on our life and open it up in various ways. And this was written in the 1300s by Keizan Jokin Zenji. Zenji is just a kind of a title. But Kate mentioned in her talk yesterday that we would talk about these two people, and Kate talked about Dogen yesterday in her talk. And I'm going to be talking about Keizan a little bit. And Keizan, in this school, is considered to be the second founder. Sometimes he's referred to as the great patriarch, whereas Dogen's referred to as the highest patriarch. Or it's reverse. I can't remember now. It's one or the other. And Dogen, he kind of brought this particular school of Soto Zen to Japan. Keizan joined that particular school at the age of 13, which was pretty common in Japan in those times. And he studied at Eiheiji, the temple that Dogen had founded. But Dogen had died already. So Keizan never met Dogen. Dogen was kind of like his grandfather, you could think of, or his great-grandfather in the Dharma. But at the age of 32, so studying for all those years, he received permission to teach Dharma transmission from his teacher, Tetsu Gikai, who was the third abbot of Eiheiji. Now, why is this guy, Keizan, known as this kind of second founder of Soto Zen? Well, it's because he and his followers, the people that he taught, are credited with spreading this Soto Zen teaching all throughout Japan, emphasizing not so much the monastic practice that Dogen had really focused on, but also other practices and teachings that really appealed to everybody. So this practice that we do became a practice that everyone could do in various forms in Japan. And so in Japan, he's revered as a great teacher for that reason, because of his ability to spread these teachings to everybody. But the other aspect is that he's also revered and known because he encouraged the training of women in Buddhism in Japan, as did Dogen, but Keizan also really insisted that women have to be equal in every way. So a very interesting person. So this book that he wrote, the Denko Roku, has 53 little enlightenment stories or awakening stories based on the legendary accounts of Dharma transmission from the Buddha all the way up to including Dogen, and then Dogen's next student, Ajo, who kind of took over from Dogen. And perhaps out of a sense of modesty, Keizan did not include his own awakening story. And he also did not include his teacher's awakening story, probably because his teacher was still alive at the time. So 53 little, you know, kind of stories about awakening. It's quite interesting, first time I've really looked at it. So the first chapter is, and we're going to look at this in a little bit detail, is the awakening of Siddhartha Gautama. And let's see what this might say about our own journey of awakening. How these texts work usually is that there's a what the actual kind of nut of the koan is the first kind of couple of lines, right? It's a little pithy thing. Then there's a little explanation by Keizan, and then a poem. And that's kind of typical if we look at collections of the of koans. So, here's what Keizan wrote. Shakyamuni Buddha realized enlightenment on seeing the morning star. He said, I and all beings on earth together attain enlightenment at the same time. I and all beings on earth together attain enlightenment at the same time. Well, so you're already enlightened according to Keizan. So here, Siddhartha Gautama, practicing diligently his meditation through the night, raises his eyes as dawn approaches and he sees the morning star, which of course is the planet Venus, right? Near the horizon. And he proclaims, I and all beings on earth together have attained enlightenment at the same time. What a kind of startling thing to say. I mean, wouldn't a more appropriate thing to say would be like, I got it? Or I did it? Or Eureka? And what is this about together with all beings on earth anyway? What would you say? What do you say when an insight comes to you? Do you say, I got it? What do you say when a solution to a problem becomes apparent? Who is this I? And what did Siddhartha Gautama realize? What did he awaken to? Was it the Four Noble Truths, the precepts, the paramitas, you know, these kind of basic teachings of Buddhism? And why? Why was it the morning star rather than, you know, reading a Buddhist text or tasting rice gruel or maybe watching a beetle scurry across his lap? Do you ever wonder these things? So let's read a little bit more and just see if Keizan gives us any help. Because now the rest of this is Keizan's commentary on this little bit of pithy gristle for us to chew on. So I'll just read a couple of paragraphs here. Shakyamuni left his palace one night when he was 19 years old and shaved off his hair. After that, he spent 6 years practicing ascetic practices. Subsequently, he sat on an indestructible seat, so immobile that there were cobwebs in his brows, a bird's nest on his head, and reeds growing up through his mat. Thus, he sat for 6 years. There's a little bit of poetic license here, as you can probably pick up. In his 30th year, on the 8th day of the 12th month. Right, December 8th. Not really, but anyway, you get the idea. Suddenly awakened when the morning star appeared. Then he spoke the foregoing words, his first lion roar. After that, he spent 49 years helping others by teaching, never staying in seclusion. With just one robe and one bowl, he lacked nothing. He taught at over 360 assemblies and then finally entrusted the treasury of the Eye of Truth, in other words, his awakening experience, to Kashyapa, and not one of his monks. And his transmission has continued on to the present. Indeed, this is the root of the transmission and practice of the true teaching in India, China, and Japan. The behavior of Shakyamuni Buddha during his lifetime is a model for the disciples he left behind. Even though he may have had the 32 special marks of greatness and the eight kinds of refinements, he kept the form of an old mendicant, no different from anyone else. Even though what the Buddha pointed out and explained in more than 360 meetings over 49 years was not the same, the various stories, parables, metaphors, and explanations did not go beyond the principle illustrated in the story of his awakening. Okay, so maybe that's not much help to our questions. But something else I think is kind of interesting in this little piece, this passage that Keizan comments here. First of all, the Buddha lived a very simple life. One robe, one bowl, and he taught continuously for 49 years, including 360 assemblies. Right? 49 years, 360 assemblies. Now, I did the math. Now that works out to only 7.34 assemblies a year. It goes on. But anyway, which is really not very much. You know, seven assemblies a year, you know, you get together, you talk. So I think Keizan is telling us that the Buddha taught more by how he lived his life, teaching through his actions more than his words, in his tender caring for the monks and nuns, the lay women and laymen, until he died. Perhaps it is this legacy of his attentive care and compassion, because perhaps it's this legacy is the reason why Buddhism has reached us today, survived over all these ages. The literature of his early life, his teaching life, is filled with stories of kindness and his wise support to others. And even though the Buddha had the marks of a great man, according to the Indian traditions, had certain kind of, not tattoos exactly, but awfully strange markings when you read the literature, he lived as an old mendicant, no different from anyone else, wandering from place to place, one bowl, one robe. And, like the sick and old everywhere, the Buddha too became ill and experienced the pains and aches of old age. And of course, he died. So what was this awakening of his that allowed him for 49 years to give his life to others? So Keizan is now going back to this, the original roar of the Buddha. I and all beings on earth together attain enlightenment at the same time. That is to say, I is not Shakyamuni Buddha. Even Shakyamuni Buddha comes from this I. And it does not only give birth to Shakyamuni Buddha. All beings on earth also come from this eye. Yeah, it's not this eye, right? It's the eye Shakyamuni Buddha. This profound eye that goes beyond Shakyamuni Buddha. Just as when you lift up a net, all the holes are raised in the same way. When Shakyamuni Buddha was enlightened, so too were all beings on earth enlightened. And it was not only all beings on earth that were enlightened, all Buddhas of past, present, and future also attained enlightenment. While this is so, do not think of Shakyamuni Buddha as having become enlightened. Do not see Shakyamuni Buddha outside of all beings on earth. Here, Keizan dismisses the traditional paradigm of Buddha as a heroic figure who finally accomplished the great journey. The eye of the Buddha's great roar is not Shakyamuni Buddha. And really, how could it be? This eye, Keizan writes, gives birth to Shakyamuni Buddha, but also to all beings on earth. Everything, Keizan is telling us, is awakening. Buddhas of the past, present, and future, everything throughout time is awakening. In this awakening, time, object, place have no hold. Another Zen teacher gave us a little, perhaps, hold on this, a little help with this. Huineng, who was the sixth patriarch in Chinese Zen tradition, wrote that the emptiness or the very boundlessness of our nature contains the 10,000 things we give names to. 10,000 things, the kind of a Chinese metaphor for everything. The boundlessness of our nature contains the 10,000 things we give names to. And all of these things are not only in our nature, they are our nature. They are our nature. Shakyamuni Buddha, in his awakening to the great nature of reality, came to see that he did not stand outside. He did not transcend the world. He was not separate from the myriad beings and the things all around him. Not separate even from the very distant morning star. And as he awoke on his seat, the morning star entered his eyes, untying that habitual knotty sense of self. And the Buddha opened to the inherent intimacy with all things. And yet, as we'll see, Keizan pushes us even to go a little further. Keizan writes, however immensely diverse the mountains, rivers, land, and forms and appearances may be, all of them are in the eye of the Buddha. In this case, he's using the metaphor of actually like this. It means extremely intimate, right? The metaphor for intimacy. And you too, are standing in the eye of the Buddha. And it's not simply that you are standing there, the eye has become you. Buddha's eye has become everyone's whole body, each standing tall. Everything expresses awakening. Therefore, this clear, bright eye that spans all time should not be thought of as the people evidently here. In other words, we are not just as we seem. We're not just, as the Chinese say, Chinese Zen masters say, skin bags. Separate skin bags. We're not just what we seem. You are Buddha's eye. A Buddha is your whole body. And yet, Kaizen does not let us get away with this idea, oh, everything's one, how sweet. Everyone's Buddha. Kaizen goes on. I ask you, is the Buddha enlightened with you? Are you awakened with the Buddha? If you say you become awakened with the Buddha, or you say the Buddha becomes awakened with you, this is not Buddha's awakening at all. Therefore, it cannot be called the principle of awakening. Even so, I and together are neither two nor one. Not two, not one. Do you awaken with the Buddha? Does the Buddha awaken with you? This is the nub of the mystery that Kaizen says we can't simply let go of. We are each of us an individual. And at the same time, in the same moment, each all-inclusive. And with these words, he puts the whole thing back in our lap. You have to taste this yourself. Kaizen knows that words and explanations only take us a short way. And that explanations mean really without our own practice to clarify, to actualize our own awakening. Our awakening that is also at the same time the awakening of all things. He writes, so study. Study from all angles, penetrate in all ways. You should clarify the Buddha's enlightenment and understand your own awakening. I want you to see this story closely and be able to explain it, letting the explanation flow from your own heart, not borrowing the words of another. Let it flow from your own heart, free from the words of another. This awakening is the endless opening of our life. Our life, as Shakyamuni did, given to the world with nothing left out, nothing held back. The Buddha's awakening took 49 years to complete. Maybe it wasn't even completed then. Maybe he's still giving, still awakening. Kaizen ends with a short verse. He writes, one branch stands out on the old apricot tree. thorns come forth at the same time. One branch stands out on the old apricot tree. Thorns come forth at the same time. The branch, like our life, is separate and yet one with the old apricot tree. How could it be otherwise? Thorns come forth at the same time. Are these our obstructions, our troubles, a sickness, old age, and death? The pains that come with every life? Or are these thorns spurs, kind of sharp reminders to pay attention to what's before our eyes, and not to become entangled with delusion? Or maybe these thorns are both. Maybe it's our very obstructions that kind of push us along. I'll end with a little poem by Dogen. Awakening is like the moon reflected in the water. The moon does not get wet, nor is the water broken. Although its light is wide and great, the moon is reflected even in a puddle an inch wide. The whole moon and the entire sky are reflected in one dewdrop on the grass. So what's your poem of awakening? How will you live this life awake? I think this is why we sit through the night once a year, kind of remind ourselves, oh yeah, oh yeah, time to wake up. And for those of us who sat up, time to go back to bed. Yeah. Well, I just want to say one last thing. For those who haven't perhaps experienced this, in our tradition, we have three big occasions. Buddha's birthday, Buddha's death, and Buddha's awakening. And it's your lucky day, because we have Buddha's awakening, and I think there'll be an explanation about how it's all going to unfold soon. So thank you very much for listening.